Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 353. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have an amazing show for you this week. We must introduce our guest right this very second. J.D. DeSalvatore is an award-winning filmmaker, producer, writer, activist, humanitarian, and so much more. Past film projects include Shelter, A Marine Story, Eating Out 2, Elena Undone, and so many others. Her films have played at film festivals all around the world, receiving over 100 awards, including a GLAAD Award, a ton of grand jury prizes, and J.D. herself receiving the Tom Tom Award from Outfest for her incredible volunteer service. J.D. has also written extensively about LGBT film for outlets including Clout, Curve, GayWire.com, PlanetOut.com, Gay.com, so many others. Her newest project is a feature documentary that I am obsessed with. It's called How to Save a Dog. But before we get to that, and probably me crying on air as we talk about that, J.D., welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
It is an honor to have you. We have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
Good thing I talk fast, right?
Let's do it. Now, talk to me about the medium of film. Why the medium of film to get your voice out there over all these years?
Well, I think we all know the power of film and television. It's actually quite huge. And when you look at, you know, social change movements, like the LGBT social change movement, it's like it operates on several basic large levels, which is, you know, one is the lawmaking and the legislation, and, you know, two would be the social services outreach and support, you know, helping people that are homeless or helping people that are suicidal or getting services to people that are drug addicted. And then, you know, another large component has always been film, television, radio, and novels and stories. So we all know, I don't know what age you are, but I just turned 50. Oh, my God. I'm in the Golden Girls age range. Anyway, I just turned 50. So people of my generation, we can talk up a storm at a cocktail party about the one gay character we saw on television over the course of 10 years. You know, like when Jody went on soap, it was like the world changed. And when Harvey Firestone made Torch Song Trilogy, I mean, let's put the, like when I was at NYU in New York, I went to go see La Caja Fall, I think 25 times.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because that was the only gay people anywhere. It wasn't in magazines. So the power of media is there. It is what it is. And it plays a bigger role with everything else that goes on. So it's not the end all be all, but you know, we already know that shows like Will and Grace and Queer Eye, we should never underestimate the huge power that they did, because they were sort of like the gateway drug to everything else. And they allowed like housewives in middle America to be like, oh, well, I like Will. He's cute. Or look at these Queer Eye guys, you know. And that just started opening the door where we weren't hated and vilified. Like people could see with their own eyes like, oh, there's nothing to be scared of. They're just like us, you know, blah, blah, blah. So media, yes, that is the power of media. And I just happen to be a filmmaker my whole life and studied it and have done it. So that's where I tend to work the best, I think, you know.
By the way, JD, most of us have been Golden Girls age since 16. So don't worry about it. We're there.
I love that show.
It's so great. It's so great. Now, is there one film that you have worked on where you would look back and say, that's the one where I learned the most about myself?
Oh, I don't know about that. You know, what's that famous quote? If making movies is like a battleground, then the critics are the ones that come in and shoot the survivors.
Yeah.
I don't know that I learned stuff on movies. The actual art of making a film is like being a general in an army. You know, it's like that. It's not about learning. And I learn things all the time. I have the most clever tricks for producing films. So I'm always happy to share, but they're boring. You know, it's like, because everything has to do with time, money, organization. It's nothing exciting.
Yeah. We've had so many of your great colleagues on the show. I remember in particular a chat we had with Marina Rice Bader, who we love, yeah, one of our favorite people around, and just talked about the state of LGBT films and the challenges in getting this content produced. You've been doing this for so long. Do you feel it's gotten a ton better?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, right now you can't complain anymore, like, because you can go, I mean, this is my advice to filmmakers, is like, go on the internet and make something, and you're going to know whether it's good or not. You don't need a studio person telling you no. You don't need a television person telling you no. You don't need the establishment telling you no. You can literally go on the internet, and if you make a project and nobody watches it, guess what? It sucks. Next one. Yeah. And then you make the next one, and it gets better because you're learning, because you're getting feedback, because it's views. And then if you think making web shows is beneath you, I mean, Lisa Kudrow made a web show, then Showtime bought it. I mean, everybody's making web shows as a way to circumvent the decision makers in Hollywood. And look how many views my show has. Great. Like that cute show, High Maintenance, which I love if you haven't seen it.
Yes.
You know, that got so many hits that HBO bought it. Today, if you have a story to tell, just tell it on the internet. Will it be hard to raise money? Make it low budgeting to start. Storytelling is storytelling. You know, and if you don't think you can do it on no money, you need to see movies like Le Jeté, which is a very compelling short film from the 60s that's told all in stills. There are things that take place in one room with a few people. It's just a matter of how good is your skill. If you're really a talented creative person, you can do it. If you say you can't do it without a lot of money and a big budget, then you're just admitting you don't have the skill set to make something entertaining within parameters.
Nice. Talk to me about your role as a producer. It strikes me that it involves a lot of hustle, that you really got to be networking and out there working hard. How is it that you have excelled so much in this producer role?
Well, I take the job extremely, extremely seriously. And then I have a lot of experience and I have a lot of education. So when I first started producing LGBT films in, you know, I think it was 2002 that I started doing that, it's not like I came to it like, hey, let's make a movie, which is what a lot of people do, which is awesome, because we have this old saying, it's like, if you only knew how hard it is, you wouldn't do it. I mean, and it is. It's like Sisyphus pushing a rock up a mountain. But I have very structured ways of doing everything, as far as systems for hiring, for systems for basically just how I do everything. You know, some of my tips I can share, I shared with somebody the other day, is like, you've got to learn that you're not, you know, if you've got control issues and you want to do everything, you know, good luck. I hire and work with who I think is incredibly talented and would know more than me in some areas. So I take an incredible amount of love and effort into picking a cinematographer and really listening to them and allowing myself to be wowed by what they bring to the table, by a director, by a writer, by an editor, by a production designer. And, by, you know, in the old days, I walk on the set and I'm like, why'd you choose to put this stuff on, you know, the set dressing? You know, why'd you choose to put this stuff on this girl's dresser? And they read the script and they intimately thought about what this character's room would look like. And then they brought it to you. I mean, you as a producer and a director are never going to get down to that minutia. Same with composers. I mean, I actually have a really active love of all these fields, you know, and love and respect, and I've studied them all a little bit. And so I hire a team because that can only make everything you do better and greater. And I also hire, unlike most of Hollywood that will hire because you have a track record, I believe in my own ability to spot talent. So I have no problem hiring the production designer that's only done a few short films, or the writer-director that's never directed a film, or the cinematographer or the composer that hasn't really done much. Because I don't need you to prove to me that you're good. I can look at your work and I can have a conversation with you, and I think I can figure out if you're good or not. If you have that skill set, then you can hire well. And I think that's why a lot of my movies, if they're good, and, which I think, you know, some of them are, of course I see all their faults, but I will tell you who is responsible for this, that, and the other. I mean, it's just amazing when a team comes together to work on something. And film is a collaborative art. So yeah. If you're making movies, like, don't just hire your friend because she shoots. Or, you know, oh, I'll have my friend do the music. You know, put an ad on Craigslist. I'm sorry, it's going to be horrible, and you're going to get 300 responses. But on every single movie you mentioned, I sat through at least 300 reels. And on my last two films, I looked at these reels at home, so the yelling and swearing and throwing things wouldn't bother my staff members. But when I'm done looking at 300 reels, I present the director with my five choices. And these people are awesome, and maybe nobody knows about them yet. You know, but will they, one, get along? I also hire based on the personality of the director, because that's something you can't change. So I try to hire people based on their personality and their body of work and how they feel emotionally towards our material. Like the editor on Shelter, you know, when my first interview with him was, I asked him about the script. You know, I don't ask him about cutting. I'm like, what do you think the problem with the script is? And he nailed exactly what there was a problem in. I don't want to say a problem in the script, but what the challenge would be. And then he told me that after he read the script, he went to Ralph's and went grocery shopping. And in the middle of an aisle, he just started crying. And I was like, this is the editor for us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, if one were to wander over to your IMDb page, they would see that you're kind of like a team unto yourself. I love that you have all of these different credits, everything, sure, the producer, but also editor, visual effects, production manager, cinematographer, and always my favorite, miscellaneous crew. You don't need a team, JD. It seems like you could just do the whole thing.
Yeah, I loved working. I was a producer in visual effects for a long time. That's the high-paying job I gave up to live in squalor and make entertaining gay films for everybody. No pressure, no stress. Do I sound like an old Jewish mother? You don't appreciate me. I used to have, you know, filtered water delivered to my house and $100 haircuts, and now I live in the valley. Enjoy my movies.
It's NYU graduates like you and I. We get to complain like that. It's fine.
I actually graduated from BU, but I went to NYU one summer. Oh my God, I loved it.
Nice. Now, you just mentioned the appreciation piece from the LGBT community. I would imagine that you very much have, even though we did a little bit of jest a second ago, that you have experienced that appreciation. I would hope that you have, because you've put out so much of the content that we have devoured.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you don't do it for appreciation. You do it, you want to see social change. You want to see the ticks in social change. So, you know, when I made Shelter, I knew what I was doing. I mean, this was a very intentional effort to make a romantic gay male movie that was G-rated so anybody could see it. I mainly did it because of my experience working at the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, where I had a young gay male staff mainly. And, you know, when you talk about, like, what's the first gay film you saw, one of them told me An Early Frost, which we all love as a movie, but, you know, did you ever think about how young gay kids seeing it would feel? He said his walk away from that movie when he was 10 or something was that if you're gay, what's going to happen is you're going to come out and your family's going to hate you and you're going to get AIDS and you're going to die.
Right.
And gay sex is so shameful, it has to happen from a long shot in a van. So after hearing hundreds of stories like that, you know, I wanted to make movies that were not like that because kids watch them. And subsequently, wouldn't you know, it's like I got letters. I mean, I could tell what country the movie was coming out in by the amount of emails from those countries, but I had people in Arab countries writing me, you know, where they could get killed if they come out. And I had teenagers writing me. I also had teenagers tell me, I showed this movie to my parents when I came out to let them know I would be okay. And then I had people our age that showed their parents, like, you know, they used it as a tool to share with people, like, it doesn't matter what you've heard, but this is what gay looks like, you know, and this is what I'm like. So that's the reward, you know. It's nice to get those festival awards, but after the first couple, you just take it, I take it as like, okay, it worked, yay. You know, because you always, after each movie, you have to be like, what worked, what didn't, what can I change, what can I do better on the next one? You know, like a business, you got to be like, okay, what worked, what didn't. If you get a couple festival awards, that's about the only time in film production where I can relax a little bit.
Nice.
I'm like, okay, we may have problems, but we kind of did something right. And then I kind of don't keep track after that because, you know, who cares, really?
Yeah.
But it seems social change. I mean, if one person calls you and said, this made a difference in my life, it's kind of almost worth everything, you know?
Oh, well, I can tell you right now, your films have made a difference in my life. I love Elena Undone, and A Marine Story is actually a film that I've used in class so many times over, so you've made a difference even in my curriculum. Let's talk about some JD ephemera, because you've done so many cool things that I want to touch on before we get to the latest project. Talk to me about the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce. I feel like we've been doing this show for 8 years, I don't know that we've ever talked about a Chamber of Commerce, but that's pretty darn important work for our community.
Yeah, I find that, and I found the work endlessly fascinating, and I was very excited to be involved. I was asked to be involved, and then I just took it very seriously. Eventually, I was the vice president in our local chamber, but what was more exciting was we got to travel. I still have very close friends from Chambers of Commerce's, LGBT Chambers of Commerce's around the country. So what we would do is try to work to empower gay-owned businesses. So whatever was going to work the best for our gay-owned businesses, especially when I was doing this work, it was during Prop 8 in Los Angeles, where everything was shockingly interconnected, if you will. I mean, we were actively not going to go to a business that was going to give money to take away our rights. So, I mean, even me, like, I had a root canal, and before, like, I was sent to the surgeon to do my root canal, at the front desk, I said, just before I drop down $3,000 on this, I need to know, are you voting yes or no on Prop 8? And what was so funny is the surgeon heard me, and they kind of laughed at me, and they let out, and they go, honey, we're Iranian. We know all about oppression. No, we're not voting against your rights, and don't worry, you'll get your rights eventually. And I was like, okay, I can drop $3,000 here.
Nice.
You know? But the way we were going, it's like we were boycotting every business that would give money to take away our rights. So inversely, it was a great opportunity for us to really promote gay-owned businesses. And mainly what this is obviously small businesses. These are not corporations. So it's real estate agents and brick-and-mortar shops and coffee makers and marketing firms. And so it's just a great way. Isn't it kind of fascinating? It's not something I was initially interested in. But then what we do is have these regional meetings. Like, we would meet a couple times a year, like, with everybody, every National Chamber of Commerce. And then with the regional ones, what was amazing is we'd sit around a table and go to a conference for a week, but you get this incredible insight into LGBT communities in Hawaii, in Seattle, in Texas, in Idaho. And you sit and you have these long talks, and sometimes you have a talk into the evening about what about the gay movement in this city? What are they doing that works? What's the taste like? And you just get to meet, like, I was so impressed with the women that ran the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. They were actively involved in politics, and their leadership and their reach was just fascinating. And the guys in Hawaii, too, a woman and a man that ran that chamber, they couldn't have been the most loving, caring, tender people, and they were actually working in an environment that was very not gay friendly. And yet they were not, you know, dissuaded. And I don't know, did they do big things? Did they accomplish a lot? Who cares? It's in the trying. So me as a person, like, I just love meeting these people and then going to D.C. and meeting activists from all over the country. I mean, I don't know if I'm making it sound fascinating, but, you know, I'm a filmmaker and I'm an activist and that's my world. But my chamber experience was awesome. And like I said, to this day, I have very, very dear friends, and we still talk about policy and issue and action items, and we still support each other. You know, you can support each other. I work, for example, I do a lot of work with the Point Foundation.
Yeah.
And, you know, recently they wanted to do some outreach in Hawaii. So I was literally able to make that connection just because I knew people. And that may, again, like, I didn't pass some huge law or go fight the Supreme Court. But, like, if everyone did just a little something like, hey, let me connect you guys, or hey, let's help one person, you know, and if everyone starts doing that and you do it just a little bit, like, holy cow, that's how we march forward with our LGBT rights in the 2000s, is everybody did a little something. Even if you just came out to your family, welcome to the movement, baby. You're not part of the movement.
Yeah. Gosh, we talk so often about that word community and where we can see it manifest. And that's one of those places where it can manifest. So great. So great. You know, another area where you've gotten involved and lent your talents and expertise is in the lesbian and gay wedding industry. Talk to us about that.
Well, that was kind of a no-brainer because I'm going to tell you, God, did we work on marriage equality? I had that quote where it was like, I wasn't joking. It's like I marched on the streets of LA like 8 days in a row. Like, I was getting a walking tour of Los Angeles. And the whole time, trust me, like, even with the violence that was perpetrated and all the politics and everything else, but I'm just like, really? You know, I'm walking on the streets of LA. But, you know, you do what you do. And what happened in Los Angeles in my community, now I'm very active in all the LGBT organizations from Outfest to GLAAD to even HRC, and of course the Gay and Lesbian Task Force and Lambda Legal, especially. I mean, there's some groups, small or big, that I'm more involved with, but I'm kind of involved with all of them in one way or another, the center, especially in those days. But everybody got involved in marriage equality, like everybody. Like, I remember once we decided to close down one of the major thoroughfares in Los Angeles during rush hour. And it was kind of hard because we had to get people to stop marching. And I'm like, maybe you don't understand. The cops want you to keep marching, but you just need to sit down because we just need to be on the news.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I can just get Oprah to say gay rights in Los Angeles, then I'll stop marching on the streets, because then it's going to move to the legal arena and all our advocates in that area will start working on social change work from the legal and law area. But we need to make a fuss to let everybody know it's not okay. But literally, everybody that was blocking that road got on Facebook and said, we're here, come join us. And they did. I remember that was around, you know, soon after I made Shelter. And, I mean, my director from Shelter showed up. I mean, you literally went on Facebook and said, come help us shut down the road. And nobody didn't do it. You know, I mean, when you talk about apathy, we got hundreds and thousands of people to turn out in an hour. Just could, by going on social media and saying, we're here, come help us. This will make a difference. This will make a little difference, but this is how we start to move forward. Wow. So, you know, I did all of that. So after I did all of that, we got marriage rights in L.A. permanently in California. So then it's just fascinating because I took the article from New York that had marriage equality before us, and they estimated that it was a $19 million revenue into the wedding business in the year since gay marriages were allowed. So I just took that article and just started walking around LA to all the wedding businesses, which is a huge industry. And I mean, goddamn if everyone didn't get on board. And then the thinking is that everyone's now going to get married at once. Like, when does this ever happen? I mean, I went broke buying presents for people. I'm like, Jesus Christ. And then they all had babies. It's like, I got no money left. You know, here's a Starbucks card. But the whole thing was like, now we get to celebrate. We get to have this. So, yeah, I produced a very large gay and lesbian wedding expo, which would basically help and assist all the LGBT couples that probably didn't know the first thing about having a wedding of any budget. Like, if you want to spend $5,000 or you want to be showy and spend $200,000, like, we were going to have resources available to you because now you've got to have this awesome wedding. So basically, it was all kind of connected for me. It wasn't just about doing the expo. It's like sort of like we get to do this now. And let me tell you the funny thing. I just told you how much I fought for marriage equality, which was horrifying day to day with how we were attacked and berated as people. And then the minute you tell them they're going to make money, like every photographer, wedding dressmaker, all of a sudden no one minds gay people when they can make, you know, $19 million. I mean, everyone's like, yay, gay marriages, you know, cake makers, everything. I mean, no, everyone's like, yay, let's do it, because there was money to be made, but whatever. But that was a blast, you know, and I hope it helped people. I hope it took the task of producing a wedding and made it, we offered resources to make that a little easier. I mean, I'll tell you, we sure had a blast doing it. Very happy to do it.
I bet. Again, listeners, we are here with J.D. DeSalvatore, award-winning filmmaker, so much more. This brings us to your latest project, How to Save a Dog. And I will say, so I don't normally talk to my guests about their health unless, you know, it's something that they are known for, but you've been very open in press releases and in doing this work and putting this project together about some of the connections between this documentary and kind of where your health is at right now. Is that fair to say?
Oh, wow. Well put. Yeah, totally. Absolutely. It's so funny because once I got cancer, like I'm terminally ill, whatever, there it is. But, you know, no one wants to hire me anymore. Like I can't work. And I'm like one of those people that I'm working. I'm still working. I'm not on disability. But no one wants to hire you. It's like, boy, what a way to feel useless all of a sudden. But boy, those dogs at the shelter, they don't care about anything. Like they're lost. They're lonely. They're scared. And sometimes when I've been working hard at the shelter and I'm too tired to go on, you know, I'll just go lay in the, we have a puppy room, but we don't put puppies in there. We actually put the old dogs in there. It's awesome. We call it Shady Pines. So I'll go in and I'll just lay down on the floor in Shady Pines, and all these dogs that are just so sad and so lonely and so scared, they just come over and they're just so happy to be with you. And like, I may not be good for much with my decrepit, dying body, but like, that's, I'm helpful to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that offering kindness to any living creature, whether it be a human or an animal. I mean, kindness is kindness. I feel I'm a big advocate for kindness, and just I get to do that now. And I may not, you know, I am laying down because I can't photograph for hours on end like in the old days, but I'm still useful, right?
Yeah.
Poor little guys, gosh. You know?
Well, so talk to us about this project. So at one point you said, you know what, I've been volunteering for so long at these shelters, I need to make this documentary.
Absolutely. Well, for two reasons. One is I just started volunteering like I did anything. You know, it's like, wow, really? We put dogs and cats to sleep? I know everybody knows that. But if you think about it a second, it's just like, I don't know, it's not right. I mean, we only have an overpopulation of cats and dogs because our society uses them as pets. So, you know, your listeners probably have a dog or a cat or a bird, or they have pets, right? So the only reason we have dogs and cats is because we selfishly we want them to be our companions and live in our homes, and we enjoy that companionship, and what they offer to us in that capacity is boundless. I mean, it's like a $60 billion industry, the pet sales industry, as far as, you know, food and clothes and things we buy for our pets. And yet we euthanize them. We kill them for no reason, really. Well, because they don't have a home. So in my little head, it just doesn't seem right. And so this is just something where, you know, it doesn't seem right. What am I going to do? Talk about it at cocktail parties? You know, so I just go and I just do the barest volunteer work. Like, I do photographs and stuff like that. You know, I'm not doing anything great. I'm just helping. But in subsequently in the 6 years that I have been volunteering, I find the work fascinating. And I think everyone else would find it fascinating. Like, I want to show you guys what I've seen. I'm going to show you what this is like. And it is really fascinating. It's really interesting. And it's kind of also not unlike our gay rights movement in the last 30, 40 years. It kind of works the same way. But, I mean, I think people will just be kind of amazed at how people go about rescue. And now's a great time to do this documentary as well, besides the fact that I'd love to share with you guys, like, what it is. I mean, obviously, I just want engagement. I want you to somehow care enough to do something, anything. Even if all you do is go on Facebook or Instagram today and share a shelter photo of a dog, like, you've just joined the movement. Welcome aboard. Thank you. You are making a difference. And it is just as huge as if you donated $1,000 or, you know, anything else. But I made the documentary now because LA has been in this movement to become a no-kill city, which is something that is happening nationally in cities where people, citizens, are basically saying, no, we as a society don't feel right about euthanizing kittens. Like, that just doesn't seem right. So can we get to the point where we have enough funding, we have enough support, we have enough education? Can we get to the point where we cannot kill animals? And how do we make that happen? So making this documentary will show you what the rescue world is like, all the various interesting people involved and what people do. But it's also going to take you on this journey to try to make our city no kill.
Yeah.
So, and I think we're kind of like the gay rights movement in the 2000s. I think we're kind of getting to a tipping point where if we can just get everyone on board, believe it or not, I think we can, in this city, we can achieve men and subsequently in other cities. So I just want to kind of educate people. And the documentary, I'm also raising money to make 30 to 50 sort of educational engagement videos for the internet, sort of fun videos that people can watch that are fun to watch, that are like educational, that will teach you something or get people involved. Like, I've had a tremendous amount of success at the shelter, the city shelter where I volunteer, with social engagement. Like, we have success after success after success. And what we've been actively doing there is community building. So we build ourselves as a community and we work as a team, and then we work with outside organizations, but we're doing a tremendous amount of public engagement in our community. Like, recently we've partnered with the neighborhood councils in all the surrounding cities, and we've gotten them. We're building an army. So I if you're listening to me now, it's like, join us. You know, it's not going to hurt. It's not going to take much. Do as little or as lot as you can. But if you join us, we can make this happen.
I'm so excited for the one video, how to introduce your new cat or dog to your other pets, because my partner and I are going to rescue a dog this summer. We know that that is part of our summer plans, and we're so excited. I will say that my cat is a little bit less excited for the incoming dog.
Right now, as I kind of told you, I'm kind of a collaborative person. So we have a committee at the shelter of volunteers. So when I want to make 30 outreach videos, I know what I think is important to do. But what we do is we talk to everybody, and I'm a big fan of statistics and numbers. So one of the volunteers just said, look, we get an abnormal amount of returns because people just can't introduce their animals. So maybe we can do like a little video, and also subsequently set up resources. We've started collecting a database of trainers, and the neighborhood councils are actually donating money to provide trainers to fosters and new adopters. Like, we see a problem, we look at the statistics, it's pretty basic. So it wouldn't have been my first video to make, but you look at the numbers and you're like, everyone's returning their animal because they bring it home and they're not sure how to introduce it to the other animal. So that's easy. Let's do a video. How hard is that going to be? And believe it or not, we've been actively doing community outreach. So we have a Facebook page where there's at least 12 of us on it. And we paid for business cards, so we could distribute the card for this Facebook page to everybody who adopts a dog. So basically what happens is now we're getting lots of emails like, my Muffy doesn't get along with Spike, what do I do? And there's 10 people there that can say, hey, try this or try that or call this trainer or have you ever thought of that? And sometimes there's a really basic thing that somebody can do to help and it solves the problem, and then the dog doesn't get returned to the shelter and then dogs don't get killed because we can't find homes for them. So videos are basically, I'm making the videos based on need. And what I'm doing, since it's impossible for me to make 30 videos, also, you know, I think I'm extremely talented, but I bet there's more talented people out there. So what I've started to do is engage award-winning documentary filmmakers that I know. I've already gotten two yeses from huge CNN-making documentary producers. So I'm actually going to engage different directors that are award-winning filmmakers to make these internet viral videos, if you will. So, you know, some of them will probably hit big and some won't, but to give you an example of the success we've had, I'm just going to give you two examples. Like 2 weeks ago, my volunteer friends are like, JD, Rocco's been here months. No one pays attention to him. He's not very active in his cage. Come make a video. I'm like, yay, that's what I do. So I run out there. I make a quickie, throw together video. This is not, you know, Eisenstein or, you know, Hitchcock. I'm just making a little video. So I made a video of Rocco. It got 60,000 hits, and 4 days later, a nice young man came and adopted Rocco, who had been otherwise just, you know, in his cage destined for euthanization because no one cared.
Right.
So that's a video. So now we have about four or five people at the shelter where I volunteer that do videos, and we have the same amount of people that do photography. And it's very, the adoption thing because of a photo or video is huge. Last year, again, looking at statistics, every 4th of July, I don't know if you know this, but I didn't. Every 4th of July at all our city shelters in Los Angeles, each shelter has a dog euthanization rate of 60, at least 60.
Whoa.
Because over the 4th of July, everyone's pet runs away because of the fireworks. They run into the street, they get picked up, they get brought to the shelter, and then all of a sudden the shelter is babysitting hundreds of dogs until their owners can come collect them, just because no one seems to hear the warnings that we put on the news and we put in the newspaper and we plaster all over Facebook about securing your dog during fireworks. So we have to kill all the dogs that we're housing currently that are homeless dogs, because we have all these home dogs that, and then if they're not microchipped, we can't even reach you. You have to come find us a week later because we have your dog. Regardless, so every year 60 dogs are killed at each shelter. So here we are, you can imagine, I bet you can imagine, like, what we're going through that Wednesday. I mean, some of the volunteers are in tears and they refuse to come in because they're not going to watch the slaughter of killing 50 dogs at our shelter for essentially no reason. For no reason, why would we kill? And, you know, we're in tears, we're frantic, we're calling every rescue in sight, every rescue is coming up, anyone that can rescue is coming, and we still are, like, they killed, I think, 1 to 3 dogs on that Wednesday, and everyone's devastated because they're perfectly fine dogs. So the shelter, my boss, the shelter coordinator, pulls me aside and is like, JD, we got to make a video. We got to make a video. Now, what do you think happened? You know, I mean, do you think we were successful? I mean, what do you think happened?
Right. I want it to be successful.
So we made a video that I literally posted at 11 o'clock at night, and I just did a call to you people, you kind people. Like, everyone else, ignore this. But if you have a heart, can you come to our shelter, register as a foster, and just take a dog for at least 4 days? And then we gave it a cute name, 4 Days for Life. 11 o'clock at night, I'm in my pajamas, I'm tired, I'm sweaty, I'm writing this plea, like, if you're reading these words, like, hear me, JD, hear my voice, like, please come and take a dog in your home. Can you do this for 4 or 5 days, right? So the next day, I run to the shelter to help. I hope it's going to work. I hope some people come. We had 150 people in the shelter.
Oh, my gosh.
And needless to say, over the course of a few days, well, actually, that day, we got every dog out of the shelter.
Wow.
And then they started taking cats. And then everyone wanted to do something. So we had photographers volunteering. We were on the news. Then subsequently now, because obviously it was hugely successful, but, you know, we didn't know it was going to be successful. And we're not doing anything. Like, we were just interviewed for the Humane Society magazine. They're like, what did you think marketing-wise? And I'm like, oh, my God, you're so funny. You're the Humane Society. I'm sure you have meetings about effectiveness and messaging and everything else. And I'm like, we're triage. We're, like, on the bottom level of this whole mission. Like, we just need to save one dog at a time, one cat at a time. Like, we don't think about anything. We were just people that didn't want our buddies at the shelter to die. And we asked for kind people. If you're kind, I mean, seriously, take a dog in your house for a couple of days. It's not the biggest deal in the world. And it's so rewarding because you can imagine, right? The dogs just are so excited. And then meanwhile, we adopted out every single one of those dogs because all of a sudden we had biographies on the dogs. And here's a photo of Muffy at the coffee house this morning. We took her out for breakfast. And all of a sudden these dogs look so desirable because they're photographed in these different environments. And then also we know all about their personalities.
Yeah.
My favorite is somebody wrote us and was like, does Daisy the boxer like cats? Because I'd like to adopt Daisy, but I have a cat. So I wrote the foster, and I'm like, does Daisy like cats? And she sent us back the cutest picture of Daisy sleeping with a little kitten.
Ugh.
She's like, yes, Daisy like cats. So needless to say, the movement was multi-tiered, and everyone, I mean, we couldn't have done it without the shelter processing, you know, hundreds of foster applications, without all the volunteers. We had to do a call to get every single volunteer at the shelter to help people with this. And then the follow-up was monumental. There were two, that's what I did. There was two of us that answered every single Facebook message from everybody. And then at the shelter, it was just monumental what they did, because the shelter coordinator had to outreach to all these rescues and disseminate the information about the dogs in the homes to get them either to a rescue or an adopter. So you've never seen so many people also 100% willing to work 24 hours a day to make this successful. And now because it was successful, the head of the whole shelter system is like, let's do this at all our shelters. So when you talk about the power of a video, when I tell you I'm going to make 30 of these videos, like, we want them to have impact, whether they're big or small, like, and I know they can have impact, you know?
They will.
One video we did had impact, and it was, again, we're not making brilliant videos here. No offense to my abilities, but, you know, it's just, we're throwing videos together.
Now, where can all of our listeners go to learn more about these videos and to get involved?
If people want to get involved, first of all, I'm humbly asking for people's support. If you can throw us a few bucks, it is absolutely not wasted. What I've been doing with the money, in addition to getting equipment and hiring people and making the actual videos, we really do need that money. But I will use the money to buy glucosamine for the older dogs. So, you know, maybe they won't limp as bad. We also have been paying, you know, $25 here and there to boost photos and videos of specific dogs that really need to get out of the shelter. Like, we have one dog, Butch, that's been at our shelter since August. You know, Jesus.
Yeah.
So that's where your money goes. So it really goes to a very good cause. And me and my team at the shelter, as it is, we put hundreds of dollars a month in, each one of us, in addition to countless hours of volunteering. I mean, it's kind of amazing how much work people put into this. But if you have a job and you can't put a lot of work into this, but you love your dog that you rescued, you know, please throw us a couple bucks. I mean, I promise you, again, if you rescue one dog or if you do one thing, it's like huge. So I have a website, How to Save a Dog, and they can go there. They can Google that and they can find us there. And also my Indiegogo has ended, but all the materials are still up at that site as well. Just Google How to Save a Dog.
Awesome. Amazing. Well, let me tell you this. You are the epitome of using your talents to make a difference. You've used the word engagement several times in our chat, and you really have provided, just over your career and certainly with this project, so many opportunities for our community and just the community at large to be engaged. And I will tell you this right this second, based on reviewing your materials and having the opportunity to speak with you and just witnessing what you have done, I have already signed up. I wasn't exactly sure what to do with my summer, JD. As a professor, I have a couple months off. I'm not really sure what I was going to do, and I've already signed up to volunteer at my local shelter, and that is...
Oh my God, tell me. Please stay in touch and let me know how it is.
I am, but let me be clear. That is 100% due to your putting content out there. I mean, I'm excited to do it because I love, we visit our shelter all the time, but pushing me towards volunteering at the shelter is 100% from witnessing the gifts that you have put out to this world.
It's so easy, and you do, like I said, I literally, to put things in perspective, like, I revolved off my board. I was a vice president of a board of directors for a nonprofit LGBT organization, and I revolved off of that, and I'm like, okay, I you can probably tell when I'm doing board work or volunteer work, I put 40 hours a week into it. So I'm like, okay, what am I going to do now? And I went to just work in the trenches as, you know, I'm just in the trenches. I'm not a decision maker. I'm not doing much. I just go and I ask them, what do you need? I still do that to this day. Every day I go into the shelter, I'm like, I go to the staff and the volunteers and I'm like, what do you need?
Yeah.
And they tell me which dogs need to be thing, or they'll be like, JD, quick, we have a dog that just got hit by a car. Can you take a photo and put it on Facebook so we can raise some money and get it to a vet? So I'm still not, you know, making big decisions here. I just make yourself useful to the people who know what they're doing is kind of what I still do, you know. I ask them, what do you need? And then I do it, you know. You'll see. I mean, well, you see, you go to your shelter, like, you look into these dogs' faces and cats, and, I mean, I fall in love with the ducks, and, you know, don't even start with me. We're having a rabbit revolution at our shelter. Speaking of, like, I host these volunteer coffee chats once a month so we can all get together and sort of work together. And somebody said, you know, all you guys do is dogs, 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 dogs. You know, we have other animals here at the shelter. And we're like, oh, wow, she's right. So we went on a mission to photograph all the other animals. So I took, like, reptiles and rodents, and my buddy did bunnies. So just so you know, there were bunnies in our shelter that had been there for 8 months, okay? And she took photographs of, I think, 15 or 16 of the 30 bunnies, and they all got adopted within the week.
Wow.
And now the dog people are walking the bunnies in our dog yards. They actually take the bunnies out like they would dogs, and they put leashes on them, and they walk them. And we have these great videos about the bunnies, and they just made the most hysterical video about our ducks. So... But again, somebody said, hey, we have other animals. You guys are spending all... The reason we spend all the time on the dogs, honey, is because they're the ones that get euthanized the most.
Yeah.
I mean, the cats do, too. I mean, we're not just doing this because we're idiots. But so all it took was somebody to say, hey, other animals need help. Your dog, 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 dog. And then we're like, oh, my God. Like, so 10 people went, let's help the other animals. And, I mean, in what field do you see such results? Within a week, we had 15 bunnies out.
Wow.
It's a beautiful home. And then they send us the pictures, and it's a little girl in her backyard with her new bunny. It's going to be her new best friend growing up, you know, and you're like, hey, we did something good. But somebody had to tell us to do it.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, you needed this. Let us do that. Because we're here to provide service, not, you know, do anything good. So our shelter, I kind of love that we have that going, because we tend, if somebody wants to do something, we tend to be very open. And we're working with the local Girl Scouts, local, you know, we can only do as much as we can do. So, but I'm very excited about this work, and we try to stay very focused on what do we do if the shelter gets overpopulated. And of course, you can imagine without me even telling you that our shelter, my shelter, I'm describing you the people I work with and the volunteers and the staff there, but the shelter where I'm at, where we do all this stuff, has the lowest euthanization rate of any city shelter in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
All due to the fact of people coming in and helping, or don't even come in and help. We have people that work from home that call rescues and set up things and call people and work towards legislation and work in, like, you don't have to go to the shelter to help the shelter.
Yeah. Let me do just a targeted message to my own boyfriend. Boyfriend, this summer, when you are looking for who to blame for when I bring home all of these cats and dogs from the shelter, that would be award-winning filmmaker J.D. DeSalvatore. J.D., what an absolute treat having you on the show. I cannot begin to express you how much you've inspired me over the years, and clearly how you're inspiring me this summer. I'm just so thankful.
Thank you. You're so sweet. Like, thanks for hearing the call. And you really have to update me on your dog. And yes, your boyfriend's going to blame me, because just a final note, like, the lead actress in Elena Undone went out and rescued a dog. The lead actress in A Marine Story Paris went out and rescued a dog. And her girlfriend's still mad at me, you know, because it was like, oh, I'm just going to foster this dog. Cut to 5 years later, you know. But everybody I know is involved in this. Like, all the actors in my films and my collaborators, they've all rescued dogs. And then it's not me having them do it. It's just that's where their heart is. They have a kindness. I think as gay people, I think we can have an understanding of what it feels like to be, like, maybe lonely,
yeah,
or maybe unwanted in one way or another. I think we understand that. So I think we're kind of like, yeah, of course we're going to rescue a dog, and we're going to do a little something for dogs.
Listeners, the name of the film is How to Save a Dog. You can just Google it, and you're going to find all of this different material. JD, on behalf of really everyone, including the pet population, thank you for doing what you're doing.
Oh, and thank you for calling and noticing and helping and helping spread the word.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy is for sale. I must take a trip to California and leave my poor sweetheart alone. If he has a dog, he won't be lonesome, and the doggy will have a good home. dog.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, gosh, J.D. DeSalvatore, incredible, incredible woman, incredible career, incredible energy that she is putting out there to the world. Since we recorded that interview last week, she has created a new website. You can go to howtosaveadog.com. That's howtosaveadog.com. And right there on howtosaveadog.com, tons of information. You can get information on her projects. You can find out how you can help, some press on there, some sponsors, all good stuff. One more time, howtosaveadog.com. We do have some time left on this week's episode, so let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news out there in Tennessee. Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Haslam, he signed House Bill 1840, House Bill 1840 into law. And now this bill is a new one. This is a great one for us. And by the way, that would be sarcasm I'm doing. It allows licensed counselors to turn away LGBT people suffering from mental health issues. This is a new frontier. Even though he vetoed a North Carolina-style bathroom bill earlier this month, he could not be persuaded to veto HB 1840. The legislation has been roundly condemned by healthcare groups and celebrities. Again, it's not just like, oh, there's an LGBT lobby and they're condemning the bathroom bill, or there's an LGBT lobby and they're condemning conversion therapy. No, respected groups, national groups that do this work are saying, hey, this isn't a good thing. So in this case with HB 1840, that would be the American Counseling Association. The American Counseling Association condemning this new bill. Again, turning away LGBT people suffering from mental health issues. That's apparently something that licensed counselors need to be able to do. Well, GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, they had a statement out about this. CEO Sarah Kate Ellis said this, quote, denying anyone vital mental health services simply because they're LGBT isn't just outrageous, it's outright dangerous. What's clear, however, is that legislative attacks that target LGBT people are bad for business. Sadly, the bedrock of Tennessee's economy, the record companies of Nashville, remained silent throughout the fight to pass this discriminatory law. It's time that they join the growing chorus of Americans demanding an end to discrimination. This legislation is expected to make it especially difficult for LGBT people in rural areas of Tennessee to obtain mental health services. The American Counseling Association noted that HB 1840 could jeopardize federal health care funding for Tennessee since it conflicts with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services mandate that says states lack the authority to deny health care to patients based on religion, race, sexual orientation, and other protected characteristics. So right there in Tennessee, apparently licensed counselors needed the right to turn away LGBT people suffering from mental health issues. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if you've ever done counseling before? You don't do pre-counseling usually when you call in to make an appointment. So you get over the stigma of actually making an appointment, because we still have stigmas out there about getting counseling. That still exists in people's minds, right? So you get over the stigma and you make an appointment, and then you actually show up for the appointment, which that's the next step. And so many people make an appointment and then they don't show up for it. All right, so we've gotten the courage to make an appointment, and then we've shown up for the appointment because we want to get some support. And then you start doing the intake, and somewhere during the intake, you reveal that you are gay. And yeah, the counselor says, oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to turn you away. You're gay. And it's Tennessee. And I have the right to turn you away. Can you imagine? Terrible. Terrible stuff. So that's in Tennessee. Some international news. A letter spearheaded by out New York Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney and signed by 33 of his congressional peers forcefully asks the Saudi ambassador to end sting operations targeting LGBT people in the country of Saudi Arabia, as well as reported incidents of torture and even capital punishment. Sent last week, the letter was addressed to Ambassador Prince Abdullah bin Fayed Faisal bin Turki Al Saud and concerned a harsh new effort to punish LGBT people in Saudi Arabia. The letter references reports, including those on social media, that Saudi Arabia's Joint Security Task Force to Fight Against Sexual Anomaly is conducting sting operations attempting to weed out LGBT Saudis. Openly lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Saudis are allegedly being charged with the same crimes as rapists and pedophiles and facing punishments that include flogging and possibly even death. The U.S. congressional letter reads this quote, "These reports are highly concerning. Our country respects the sovereignty and cultural traditions of other nations. We want to be clear, however, that the persecution, torture, and execution of members of the LGBTQ community are clear violations of human rights. Such actions will be an impediment to the mutually beneficial relations that should exist between our two nations." So all of the U.S. Congress's out LGB members signed the bill. It went out there to our Saudi ambassador, and we'll see if there's a response. It's important to use your voice, even if there's no response. So the U.S. standing up for LGBTQ brothers and sisters all over the world. Back to the U.S., let's talk about Missouri. Some good news, kind of. It was a bit of a tie, but still comes out on our end. Missouri's House Emerging Issues Committee, this week they voted down a controversial anti-LGBT religious freedom bill with a tie. It was a tie, 6-6 vote. That 6-6 vote effectively kills the bill for this legislative session. Mike Colonna, the only openly gay politician in the Missouri legislature, shared his coming out story during an emotional half hour of testimony that left many in tears. During that, he said this, quote, "What you witnessed here today was a reflection of what Missourians are really all about." House Minority Leader Jacob Hummel said this, quote, "The ultimate issue here is whether our state constitution protects all Missourians or grants special rights to some to detriment of others. In the years to come, I am confident today's action will be remembered as being on the right side of history." But yeah, look at what Mike Colonna, the only openly gay politician in the Missouri legislature, did. By sharing his coming out story, and many have said in the media, him sharing all of that made a huge difference. And so if you're in that place where you can share your story with other people, it really does make a difference. Here, on the political level, it made a huge difference. So kudos to Mike Colonna, the only openly gay politician in the Missouri legislature who shared his story. On the health side of equation, a study came out that says that young gay and bisexual men are at significantly greater risk of poor mental health than older men in that group. And this is according to new research published in the Journal of Public Health. Conducted by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and funded by Stonewall, the study found gay and bisexual men under the age of 26 were six times more likely to attempt suicide or self-harm compared to men in that group aged over 45. They were also twice as likely to be depressed or anxious. The researchers say the results reinforce the importance of mental health interventions reaching those who need them most, as well as people who actively seek help. So again, let me cover this again for you. Let's be very clear. Gay and bisexual men, this is according to a new study, gay and bisexual men under the age of 26 were 6 times more likely to attempt suicide or self-harm compared to men in that group, and twice as likely to be depressed or anxious. And we know from so much research that has been previously put out there that our LGBT brothers and sisters are at disproportionately higher risk for depression, for anxiety, for suicidality, right? It's not because it's in our DNA. It's because we're responding to social pressures out there that are telling us that what we're doing, as if we're doing something other than just being our authentic selves, but that being our authentic selves are wrong, right? So we're at disproportionately higher risk, and then we're able to somehow get over the stigma of making an appointment with a mental health counselor or a therapist. And then we actually show up for that appointment, and then we remember, oh gosh, we live in Tennessee. And now that therapist has the right to just stop us in the middle of a session and say, "I'm so sorry, I can't help you." it's not difficult to imagine that that same individual will never seek support again. What an absolutely rejecting experience for them. Or they get up the courage to talk to one of their faith leaders, and their faith leader, who is also a licensed therapist, stops them in their tracks and says, "I'm sorry, I'm not having this conversation with you. I cannot support you. If you live in the state of Tennessee, you must raise up your voice." But as we've been telling you for 7+ years on the show, it's not just about if you live in the affected state. It's also about making sure that this is not happening in your state, doing some proactive work. Here in Ohio, we don't have yet, hopefully never, but we don't have yet one of those bills that is going to give businesses the right to discriminate. We don't have it yet, but that's not stopping Equality Ohio. That's not stopping Equality Ohio from doing some proactive work. We have this initiative here called Ohio Competes, where we've gathered together the names of the top businesses in Ohio to say, hey, we're not discriminating here. Sure, it's proactive if a bill ever comes up. We don't have to be defensive and gather all the support as you're seeing in North Carolina. They've done incredible things there in North Carolina to gather together the names of all these businesses that have banded together to say, hey, this is not okay. What you've passed here is not okay. Here in Ohio, we're trying to say, hey, we already have these groups together. We don't have to do reactionary work. But it also can serve the effect of maybe we do want to be even more proactive and pass a more comprehensive non-discrimination law, which we don't have here in Ohio. We don't have employment protections here in Ohio. We don't have that essential job security, that essential public accommodations protections. We don't have that here. So trying to do that proactive work here, and we then get to role model that for other states. So incredible work happening out there. Last story. You have to see some of the humor in this. Steve Pawells, a pastor in Londonderry, New Hampshire, which I've been to many times, big tennis community there in Londonderry, New Hampshire. He's not very happy about the inclusion of gay and transgender characters in superhero comic books. His anger led the openly homophobic pastor to call on his fellow anti-LGBT activists to rise up as he warned the Rainbow Mafia to, quote, leave Captain America alone. This was in a column posted on barbwire.com. In it, the pastor claims that the so-called Rainbow Mafia has utterly contaminated healthy male friendship. He said, quote, sodomite supremacists are driven by a psychic rage to completely destroy all culture, even comic books. He said this, quote, when I was a teenager, Captain America was probably my favorite comic book hero. Every month I'd eagerly look forward to the newest issue of Captain America and the Falcon. The Falcon, you ask? He was the red, white, and blue Avengers African-American partner. Partner as in crime-fighting teammate, not as in the fellow who, after a full day of busting bad guys with Captain America, did things with him in the dark that would make most comic aficionados go, ew. Yes, back in the mid-late 1970s, partner still just meant, well, partner, nothing more salacious. And then he goes on to say that the Rainbow Mafia is corrupting superheroes. That, my friends, really is all the time we have left for this week's episode. Again, howtosaveadog.com. Our huge thanks to J.D. DeSalvatore. Incredible, incredible career, incredible energy. So appreciative. You guys get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?